Welcome to Free For All Friday. It is January, pro-life month, something we often think about because this is the month when Roe versus Wade was handed down. Thankfully, that has been overturned, but the fight for life continues. We still have the March for Life going on. So I wanted to share with you today an interview that I gave with Amber Rose, aka the religious hippie, on pro-life, on how the pro-life movement needs to succeed, and where younger people can help us in this movement. So check it out.
How has the apologetics kind of just, I don't know, morphed over the years? What were we dealing with, I don't know, even 10 years ago to what it is now, the differences?
Sure. I think that there's also kind of a change in culture. I don't know if the argument has changed that much. I just think over the past 10, 20 years, our culture has become more hardened and darkened over time. I remember when I would do pro-life apologetics on college campuses in the early 2000s, we could set up an exhibit with pictures of the unborn. People would come and debate and talk about it, and they were shocked by these images that they saw. But after smartphones debuted in 2007, and then you get on to the 2010s, people are just kind of buried in their phones, and they weren't really shocked by this material anymore, because they see all kinds of shocking things on their phones all the time. And I think people were more desensitized to pornography, to fornication, hookup culture, Tinder. So people are much more willing to want to incorporate abortion as a safety valve, an escape hatch for life becoming more and more degenerate, basically. So I think people are more willing to sidestep the issue of what are the unborn than they are to engage it. So what I notice is people really sidestep it a lot more. Sometimes people will accept the unborn or human, and they'll use a bodily rights argument, or they'll just try to say, you know, it's my body, I get to do what I want. And you need to call people out when they're just making this sort of argument from power. Like, you know, okay, you're bigger, so you get to decide what happens to smaller people. How is that fair? So I don't think the main argument, I would say, has not changed. We're always just trying to get people back to it as much as we can.
Right. I think especially because you wrote that book, Persuasive Pro-Life, and that's one of the first pro-life books I read to kind of figure out how to address these problems. But you're absolutely right with the issue of the culture just becoming more degenerate and viewing it almost as like a cop-out, in the same way that because marriage is no longer this sacrament and it's become more degenerate as well, that divorce is the cop-out. And it's very interesting to see how my generation specifically is kind of divided on this. And how do you reach people who can see these images of aborted babies and just go meh, or pour tomato sauce over it and also assault pro-lifers?
Yeah, I think that the people who would do that, they tend to be in the minority. We always have to remember that the internet is not real life. So there's always going to be people who are shocking, who are callous, and who respond in sort of a trollish way when they're presented with the evidence. And some of those people, when they see pictures of aborted unborn children, for example, may respond in a heartless way. And you might think, oh, this doesn't have an effect on them. But this trolling behavior is what they do because they actually do feel bad inside. And so they want to throw you off your game, or they want to run away from those emotions. You never know how it's actually affecting people. You can't always take people at their word in how they're acting. But I think most people who see these kinds of images, they will still fall back on the idea, well, yeah, that's sad, but, and then they'll talk about how abortion is needed for X, Y, and Z. So we need to get people off of thinking abortion is bad in the same way that killing Old Yeller at the end of Old Yeller is bad. Yeah, it's sad. They say, but, you know, we need it for X, Y, and Z. No, no, no. Abortion is not like euthanizing a pet. It is the killing of a human being. It's the killing of a human being who's just a little bit younger than a toddler or an infant. And to say, would you be okay doing this to a toddler or an infant in a tough situation? And if you're not, what's the difference? Tell me, and really confront them. Because most people, when it comes to abortion, they have conflicting views and they don't think about it. Abortion is sad, but they want it to be legal. They think all human beings should be protected from harm, but they, you know, think the unborn is a human being that can be aborted. Most people are just, they have a set of confused and contradictory positions on this issue. And our goal is to really show them, hey, you're confused and contradictory. Pick a lane. Are you going to, you know, say that this is not a human being, it's not a big deal, who cares? Or this is a human being and this can't be justified. I've heard it said before that if the unborn are not human beings, abortion needs no justification. But if the unborn are human beings, abortion can't be justified.
Oh, yeah, that is so true. And the analogy between animals and babies. I mean, so many people these days are quote unquote cat moms or dog moms. And I might even offend some of my listeners by saying that. But I mean, animals don't make you a mother. And I think a lot of the times this separation of
Pope Francis would say the same thing, actually. He's very critical of people who select pets over having children. So
it's selfish. Yeah. I mean, in a way, if you look at it. Yeah. And I think especially because animals can't suffer. They can feel pain, of course, but they can't suffer because they don't have the intellect that we do. And so as humans, babies suffer in the womb when they are suction cupped out, basically, like through vacuums and, you know, poisoned with poison that is meant for to kill people in prison. It's like a specific type of poison.
Well, I do know that late-term abortions use digoxin, which is something that stops a child's heart. That happens in a late-term abortion. But what's interesting here, and there is debate about how early into pregnancy unborn children feel pain. But honestly, even if children felt pain from the moment of conception, pro-choice advocates wouldn't give up abortion. They would just say, well, we'll just do it painlessly, just like how we euthanize cats and dogs. We'll just use anesthesia and still kill these individuals. And so the thing that these children, you're correct that they suffer in one definite certain sense, that the greatest thing these children suffer in abortion is they suffer the loss of a future like ours, the loss of a life ahead of them. I mean, it's so interesting. I remember when I've been to a few funerals in my life. I went to one funeral for a 19-year-old friend. I gave the eulogy at that funeral. And then I went to a funeral for another teenager who died. And then I went to the funeral for my wife's grandmother. And she was 99 years old.
Wow.
But it's so funny, just the different attitudes that are there. Like at her funeral for my wife's grandmother, people were just like smiling and they were laughing. And I mean, they weren't being macabre or anything, but it's almost like a celebration. I have a bit of a dark sense of humor. When you do pro-life, you kind of have to have a dark sense of humor because it's a grim subject. But when people like get past the age of life expectancy, like past 80 or 85, now the Grim Reaper's sort of the underdog in this story. You know, I mean, it's like now they're the underdog trying like, man, how's this person keep getting away from me? So 99 years old, it's like, okay, she's lived a long and full life. But then when you see like teenagers, the tragedy there is a life that was not lived. And especially when you look at children and young children and you extrapolate backwards, you know, well, think about the unborn, the life they had ahead of them that we take from them. Now, sorry, I don't mean to interrupt myself, but whenever I say things, I always have to head off objections people make. And what they'll say is, well, why don't you feel that way about, you know, miscarriages? And what about that? Are they not really persons? Because a lot of pregnancies end in miscarriage, for example. But that doesn't follow just because a lot of children die naturally before they're born, that they're not human beings or they're not valuable or their lives don't matter. Let's say, for example, that half of all pregnancies end in miscarriage, you know, or fail to implant. Let's say 50%. Throughout most of human history, half of all children, the child mortality rate was 50%. And it's this case, actually, in some parts of the world today, it's still that high. That means that throughout most of human history, half of all children did not live to see their fifth birthday. They died of dysentery or the diseases or accidents as a toddler. So half of all children didn't make it to the age of five, but it wouldn't follow, therefore, that it would be moral to directly kill toddlers just because they have a high mortality rate anyways. So to put it all together, you can explain to people like what's so tragic about abortion is this is a new, unique individual human being who will never be duplicated. And to end their life cuts short a valuable, unique life of someone like you or me.
Right. And I mean, I think about all the children who are aborted who could be doctors, could be saints, could be priests and religious. And, you know, we have such an issue in our world where we don't appreciate life, but we also don't respect life at all. I mean, euthanasia is a huge thing now. And abortion's been a thing for a very, very long time. And I've always kind of found this decline in society since we've seen abortion take more of an uptake, and the less we respect life, the more the quality of life for those who are alive actually kind of goes down a little bit, because our leaders and things don't seem to, they don't really seem to, if they don't, you know, if they don't respect the smallest life, the most innocent life, why would they take care of us? You know, and that worries me. Yeah.
Right. That's a similar argument. Pope St. John Paul II makes a similar argument in his encyclical, The Gospel of Life. And he coined the phrase, abortion promotes a culture of death. And there's actually a great book, Don DeMarco, I think, wrote it, called Architects of the Culture of Death. It's like a mini biography of like 20 people, like Margaret Sanger and Marx and other people. And he calls these people create a society where utility is valued rather than the intrinsic dignity of every person, every human being.
What would you say? So knowing how the pro-life movement is, do you think they're being more or less effective or about the same with the approaches that they're making these days to help eradicate abortion or just bring, education to people who don't know about it?
I think it depends on the pro-life advocates. I think some approaches are going to be more successful than others. And there's lots of different pro-lifers. It's a very fragmented movement. It's not like it's unified and there's just like one king of the pro-lifers that orders and directs everyone. People have different approaches. I would say there are really three branches of the pro-life movement. There is the pastoral wing that primarily focuses on helping women with unintended pregnancies. There's the educational wing that works to educate people about the wrongness of abortion. And then there's the political wing that seeks to pass laws to restrict abortion. Mm-hmm. And so each of them, the idea is if they all work together, they can achieve their goal. Like if there are fewer people seeking abortion, then it's going to be easier to outlaw it. And if more people are educated to see abortion as wrong, it's easier to get them to vote to protect unborn children. So there's different ways. And I think each of these can be done well and each of them can be done poorly. So there are some pregnancy resource centers that do an amazing job of reaching women who are abortion minded. And there are some that only provide resources for people who are in poverty, which is still a good thing. We should help people who are in poverty, but we don't want to neglect the people who are seriously considering having an abortion and reaching them. Likewise, there are laws that aren't as successful. You have some pro-life groups that will try to pass a law or they'll try to stop a pro-abortion law. And I remember one of the states, like the campaign literature, like the signs and that were put out, the yard signs, they just looked very unprofessional. Whereas the pro-aborts, they get really slick graphic designers. They know how to make things look appealing, especially to women. So I think that there's a lot of places where I really do wish the pro-life movement would hand the reins over to younger people, especially like Gen Z, to show, hey, help to get this message out there in a way that's appealing, especially the demographic who is most vociferous about abortion, age 18 to 29. Those women, abortion was like the number one issue for them in the previous election. So I also think messaging, like I hate the messaging, choose life. Like this is not like choosing a gas station or a soda product at the store. Like choose this, not that. That makes it seem like it's just about making sure people make a more tasteful choice. No, we don't say if someone's like, oh, I don't, you know, I lost my job, so I'm going to go kill my 2-year-old. No, don't do that. Choose life. There's many resources. We say, what are you doing? You can't kill human beings. That's wrong. That's murder. Right. And so I think we need to be a little bit more blunt, but still be gracious when we're engaging people.
Do you think that the language we use does need to kind of be revamped and sort of altered and have more of a specific, like you're saying, you know, because I've always thought like choose life was something that made sense because it was like, obviously you choose life, but that made sense to me, someone who was already a pro-lifer.
Right.
And I feel like what you're saying is spot on with the fact that we need to be more precise with the language we use so that people really understand the gravity. Is that something you agree with?
Yeah. Think about the difference between the phrase, two phrases, choose life and don't kill your baby. Like what one gets your attention a lot faster and just hits you across the head. Now I think that some people are concerned that pro-lifers, you don't want to like shout in somebody's face that they're a baby killer and come off incredibly off-putting. So we rush to the far extreme to avoid being off-putting. But you can present these truths. I, in a very calm and collected way, will say abortion is the dismemberment of tiny human beings. How can a civilized society allow that? So I think we have to have a measured tone that uses graphic and visceral language. And a lot of language that I'll use, I'll just quote from abortion providers or the Supreme or Supreme Court cases that describe abortion and say, these aren't even my words. These are the words of the people who defend this stuff. How could you defend it?
Mm, yeah, no, that's really good. I think also what you were saying about Gen Z coming into the, you know, the main sphere, I really do believe that the baton is slowly being passed to us. Maybe not as quickly as I would like it, but
it is hard. I mean, I remember. I always feel no offense, but I always feel old when I talk to you. But I think that's an okay thing. I don't mean to be disparaging, but I want to say things like when I was your age. But I remember, you know, being a 20-year-old, 21-year-old, going out, being excited, going to campuses, trying to do pro-life work. And working with pro-life organizations, and a lot of times the leadership would not want to go along with stuff or think, oh, we've always done it this way, so we need to keep doing it this way, and just not wanting to listen. And it's just amazing to me. I feel like 20 years has passed and those same people in some cases are still in charge, and your generation's hearing the same thing I heard.
Yep. It's so true. And especially because we're the generation of tech and we're the generation of design and just being chronically online, which isn't the best, I will say. But we know the culture online and how to best reach people online. And when, you know, older people who have been in it too long maybe and are just like stuck in their ways, like you're saying, or maybe they just don't really understand how to use the internet or reach younger people, it can become very frustrating, I think, for younger generations. Yeah. But one thing I have noticed is they've kind of taken it into their own hands. And instead of necessarily joining an organization, they start their own page or their kind of like their own little group.
Do it. That's the way to do it. And it will grow and people will notice things and support it. But yeah, I think that sometimes people, even in my generation, in the millennial generation, they can just get really, I don't know, crotchety or curmudgeonly about some of it. Like the whole Luce thing. Like, I think Luce looks cool. I mean, I have different eclectic tastes and things like that. But I love the one meme where like she's like running out of Planned Parenthood, you know, with the babies and the ninjas are chasing after her. I love that stuff. And I could see younger people, like even someone who's like ambiguous about abortion, ambivalent about abortion, seeing that and just like, oh, makes you think about something. And it's something my generation and older, you know, not even older. I think when it comes to Luce, I think it's like the boomers and the zoomers love Luce. And then it's just the millennials. I'm like, guys, come on, just relax a little bit. It's fine.
I think that's the hard thing is like people being so uptight these days is they think that they don't understand the long game either in a lot of things. With Luce, when they first released her, I was kind of like, meh, I mean, I'm not a huge fan. I don't think it really helps, but I think she's cute. I don't know. It grew on me after a while. I was like, okay. You know, kind of just being like, meh, I don't think it hurts, but I don't think it helps. But like, I think she's cute. And I agree. I love the memes. The memes, that's the first thing when they released her is what I tweeted on X. Memes, I was like, I can't wait for the memes. But I do think that, you know, when it comes down to it, though, people are a little bit, I mean, being online, this could have hardened people, but a little more rigid in the way that they address people online. I think we kind of talked about that last time I had you on, which was, you know, but basically how people are less likely to really evangelize properly to people online as opposed to face to face because, you know, you can just block them or, you know, turn off, you know, you're braver when you're online. And that's something that I've seen where people don't understand that sometimes online, you do have to play the long game with people. And that goes with, you know, Catholicism, but also abortion, where sometimes you might start a discussion with somebody, but they're not going to change their mind that second. It might be a couple weeks, a couple months, a few years even, but, you know, just throwing facts in people's faces, being like, choose life or this or that. It doesn't really change people's minds until you have that deeper conversation.
Yeah, and I think even if you're blunt and you tell someone online abortion kills babies, they might respond back to you in a trolling sort of way, which is why I find the most effective way is to ask questions like, where do you draw the line? You draw it at birth or 9 months or 6 months or wherever. Why did you draw the line there and not one day before? Help me understand that. So, and that's why online people rarely have conversations like that. So it's not as effective, but it can be. That's why I really don't get into a lot of conversations online. It's a giant waste of time. But if you can, I think taking that question-based approach to really help someone see that their worldview is contradictory, that can just be really, really helpful. But people, they just adopt another persona, especially if they're anonymous, that really caters to some of their, just their basest instincts and worst ways of like treating other people.
Yeah, especially if they're anonymous.
Especially.
And I just think that that's so interesting how there's kind of been this like dehumanizing aspect to social media.
Yeah.
Where, like you were saying, when you were in your 20s, you were going to campuses, you were talking to people, you were having that heart-to-heart, face-to-face connection.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and that I feel like really changes more lives than anything. But now, because of the introduction of social media, and this could be completely wrong, you could just, you know, you could tell me I'm wrong, but I do feel like now some pro-lifers, when they go on campus, they act the same way they do on social media, where they're just like throwing facts out at people and stuff. And not all of them, of course. Some of them do it very, very well.
Yeah.
But some of them get kind of riled up and they're just like, well, did you know you're killing your baby? And it's like, what? Right. How did we get there?
Right. And sometimes even that line can be helpful when it's dropped in the proper context, when somebody just needs to hear it and is open to it. But you're right. The ability to engage people is a skill. And like all skills, it takes time and practice to get good at it. So if you spend most of your time engaging people through social media, through unhealthy social media communication, you're not going to be as good at it when you're trying to talk to somebody face to face. Whereas you're right, like 20 years ago when we were doing this on campus, we had a lot more experience just talking to people in general, whether it was on campus, in class, off campus, hanging out with people after class, all of our conversations. We also people would text message, but it wasn't as crazy as it is now. We had no problem with face-to-face communication. That's why one of the generational divides, my wife, Laura, is a baby millennial, and I'm a geriatric millennial. She's still firmly in the millennial camp, but she's on the younger end, I'm on the older end. And I remember when we started dating, like she would text me, and then I would call her and she didn't pick up the phone, and then she would text me back. And I was like, why didn't you pick up the phone? She's like, oh, I don't like talking on the phone. That she was a part of that generation that just only wanted to text and I only wanted to call. And so that I think that there is that divide that has grown since then.
Yeah, I've definitely noticed a little bit more, especially after 2020, COVID and everything. I think I noticed it a lot more. And I think people are really hungry though for personal conversation.
Mm-hmm. I agree. And we need to be able to reach out to people and offer that, whether it's on campus or at work or in other ways that we engage people.
Yeah. What would you say would be, well, I guess, what are the most like, not outrageous, but like, what are the most common like misconceptions have you been hearing recently, whether online or offline, about abortion that you feel like we need to address the most? Like, what are the most important ones right now?
Yeah, I think that a lot of people are saying, oh, if pro-lifers outlaw abortion, women can't get care for miscarriages.
Oh,
I would
say
that's absolutely not true. Miscarriage, when a child has died, you can remove a child who has perished in his mother's body. That absolutely is not abortion. Every state that has outlawed abortion in some way has an exception if a woman's life or health is in danger. And so just to point that out, and some people will say, well, you know, what about a woman who's accused of doing abortion and it's just a miscarriage? You can say, well, look, sometimes people are falsely accused of child abuse. Like you bring your child falls down the stairs, right? You take him to the hospital and they're like, why is he so banged up and his arm's broken? He fell down the stairs. And doctor rolls their eyes. Oh, he fell down the stairs and calls the police. Like, no, he really did fall down the stairs. But it's, you know, are you going to say, look, some people are falsely accused of child abuse, so we should get rid of child abuse laws? No, we should just work really hard to make sure people aren't falsely accused, but we need to protect children from abuse, whether it's after birth or before birth. So I think we can make that analogy with people, but we can focus on saying, look, at the very least, do you think elective abortion, abortion that is done for just because a woman no longer wants to be pregnant or have a baby, should that be illegal? When we know in that case, and that's the vast majority of cases. So I think that there's a lot of these lies that are put forward. I covered that in my reviews of the presidential and vice presidential debates on abortion. But I'm trying to think if there's any other. I think that's one of the biggest ones, that like doctors won't be able to treat legitimate health problems in women if abortion is banned. And that's not true. We can say, look, doctors should treat the mother and the child as a patient. You can say, look, should doctors be allowed to treat unborn children as a patient? And they do that if a woman's miscarrying and says, hey, I don't want to miscarry. Can you help me? And the doctor says, sure, I'll give you progesterone or this or that. So, or, you know, a child has spina bifida and you do a surgery in the womb. So we're already okay with doctors treating wanted unborn children as patients. You could ask someone, why don't we treat the unwanted ones as patients also?
Right. And I think that's very interesting because, you know, with the election and everything, abortion was one of the biggest topics. And it seemed as though a lot of Catholics were voting for a very, very, very pro-abortion person. You know, was very interesting to me. I'm like, Catholics, come guys, get your together. What? I mean, it just blew my mind how many, I think it was like, don't quote me on the statistics. I don't know if you know the statistics, but I thought it was like something 60% or something.
I think actually Trump ended up getting the majority of the Catholic vote.
Did he? Okay. Oh my gosh. Yes. Because when it was like first coming out, it was like Catholic.
I think that was the polls. That was just the polls that were coming around when Harris had a high point in the polls, and that kept dropping over time. Okay. I think people, you know, some of those people are pro-choice and they think they're just poorly catechized. I mean, you've got so many people who say they're Catholic and have no idea what the Catholic Church teaches. Yeah. So that's typical. I think some people will say, well, the president can't really affect abortion that much. And so I really don't like Donald Trump, and that's why and the president doesn't matter anyways. But they're not taking into account that that Harris was planning to codify Roe v. Wade at the federal level, which means like where I live in Texas, abortion would be completely legal again. And we achieved a victory and we've made it illegal here. So I love that there's no abortion facility I can take my kids to pray at anymore. We pray at abortion facilities if we go out of state on vacation, because there's none here to pray at. And I would like to keep it that way. So I think that just like an ignorance there, or thinking that abortion is just a social problem. Like, well, if I vote for Harris, then poverty rates will go down and abortions rates will go down. And all of those inferences are incredibly sketchy. That the economy would improve. I mean, she managed to blow through $1 billion and is still $20 million in debt after her campaign. Yeah. So, you know, imagine the economy after that. Even Snopes has debunked the idea that abortion rates go down during Democratic presidential administrations, because the president doesn't have that much control over the economy, over not just the economy, but how it affects abortion rates. Really, what we've seen since 2017 is abortion rates went up, not because like Trump did something, but because you have a lot of states where Medicaid was now allowed to pay for abortion. The FDA allowed for the abortion pill to be prescribed over the phone or over Zoom. So it became more accessible. And so the rates would have been way higher if Dobbs hadn't allowed places like Georgia and Texas to outlaw it.
Right. Okay. Yeah. No, that makes a lot of sense. I think it's almost difficult because, I mean, Roe v. Wade was overturned. That's a huge thing. But now we also have to deal with it on a state level, which can sometimes be a lot more tricky. Not more tricky, but in a lot of blue states, it can be, especially since, I mean, I live in one of the abortion havens. Illinois is known to be that. And there's signs everywhere saying abortion is healthcare and get your abortion today over Chicago.
It had one of the biggest increases when I was looking at from 2017 to 2021. One of the reasons abortions went up in the country overall, even though they went down in some states, is because it went up in Illinois. Medicaid increased. They constructed new abortion facilities in that state. I feel bad for you, but like Illinois is like California with awful weather. So
it literally sucks so bad. I mean, hopefully we won't be here for much longer.
You got to flee at the very least. I know like other states like Texas and Florida could be far from you. You could at least hop over to Indiana.
Yeah, kind of our plan. That's our plan. Potentially South Bend, maybe.
Yeah, it's something at least. I know friends that just moved to Notre Dame, to South Bend, actually. Yeah. So, yeah.
It's a beautiful town. And I'm hoping, I'm like, oh, yeah. Please. I think
More people, we got to get them more people like-minded together, but go ahead.
Yes. No, I agree because, you know, we're stronger when we're together. And I think that's really what it comes down to is we're spread out too thinly. And I think we really need to kind of concentrate and build not just the spiritual warfare aspect against abortion together, but also, you know, advocating together. Because sometimes people just don't have anybody they can go and advocate with and they don't feel safe. And I mean, I don't blame them. There were multiple times when I was with people and I was like, I don't feel safe. Some lady was chasing me with a frying pan in 2021, like Chicago March for Life. I was like, what is going on?
Like a pro-abort person?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because ISIS was there.
That's crazy.
There was like this whole thing.
Who was there?
ISIS.
Like the terrorists?
Yeah, they said that they were there. There was a whole like news coverage thing. And I was like, I mean, there were so many cops. It was crazy.
That's really wild. Like you have ISIS and then you have a woman. Are you sure she was after you and not just her husband for not taking out the trash? Like when I see a woman running with a frying pan, I think of like those old cartoons and she's going to bonk her husband on the head and he'll have like the big lump. But that is,
I mean, if I looked like her wild. Husband, I'd be like, whew.
Right. We need to have good voices in all the places, especially the crazy places. So I always give a lot of credit to pro-lifers who are still in California, Illinois, Minnesota, because any gains they can make there, it's a lot when you have such an opposition against you.
It's so true. And I think especially in this election, we kind of saw that California is split up into almost like two states. And of course, it's, you know, south, north, the big cities are blue and stuff. But I've definitely felt like, you know, there's might be not a chance to overturn some of those states becoming more red, but just a chance for us to kind of get a foothold in the door as pro-lifers to kind of push more pro-life agendas.
Yeah. Well, you never know. I mean, Florida used to be a pretty liberal state. And now it used to, because back in the year 2000, I mean, it was a really big toss up about whether a Republican could win. And that was the big controversy with 2000 election was counting all the votes in Florida. But it used to be fairly liberal and pro-abortion. And now it is reliably conservative, very pro-life. I mean, it is hard. Even in Florida, the vote to pass their abortion amendment, it failed barely. 57% voted for it. So even there in Florida, you've got difficulties, but at least it was still stopped in its tracks there. But that's one of the things pro-lifers have to look out for. I think really we have to focus on the 20% in the middle who call themselves pro-life, but they're actually pro-choice and they'll vote pro-choice. They just like the label pro-life. Yeah. And we got to get them to see that they've failed to fully grasp the moral reality of the situation.
Yeah, you know, I think somebody who comes to mind with that was this girl who was a pro-life advocate, and I won't name her, but it was going around Twitter, you know.
Exactly, I think I remember this story. Yeah, yes.
She was a very big pro-life advocate, went on tons of podcasts, was very popular, and then she just recently aborted her child, and now she's like completely pro-choice.
And that, honestly, to me, the sad thing there, I mean, obviously it's tragic that she had an abortion, but the sad thing there is then to double down. It'd be one thing if you said, you know, I'm a hypocrite. I failed. I have to take time to repent of what I did because we're all human. I mean, we all try to. It's better to have a standard you fail to live up to than to have no standard at all. Yeah. Right. It's always hard, right? As Christians, for non-Christians, especially secularists to attack us, to say, you know, look at this horrible Christian. Look at that horrible Christian. And it's especially hard when it's like you're horrible because it's one thing to be a bad person, but people really, really hate hypocrisy. And I understand that. to fail when you say you're not that kind of person. Mm-hmm. But it's like, when's the last time you met a hypocritical atheist? I mean, at best, it's like someone who says God doesn't exist. And then when the poo hits the fan, they're praying. I mean, there might be some like that. But normally it's just like, oh, they're a bad atheist, but it has nothing to do with atheism. Mm-hmm. So it's like, yeah, you can have a belief system where it's hard to be a hypocrite. But that's just because you don't have a lot of moral values baked into your belief system. I'd rather be a part of something where it's easy to be a hypocrite because what I believe guides me in every aspect of my life and calls me to that higher standard empowered by the grace of God. So, yeah, so it is hard, but seeing that, and there have always been stories of people like that. And you just have to pray for these individuals and always remember, whether it's a pro-life or ministry, like people who are caught up in sex abuse scandals, none of us is above temptation. None of us is above grave sin, you know?
Yeah, I think, you know, I think what really made her double down, though, was probably a lot of the hate that she got. Yeah. And I think a lot of pro-lifers forget that we do need to show mercy and compassion.
Yeah.
And we don't, you know, I think it's also difficult when she knew what she was doing, and it was just such a confusing situation, but compassion is always the better way to go.
Yeah.
When it comes to people who have gone through something like that, where do you draw the line on kind of like, I guess, speaking truth and telling people what abortion is without going over the line? I know that a lot of the times it depends on the person and the context, but what is the line?
Well, I think the line is just whether they're willing to talk with you. And if you can tell they're just really uncomfortable and they're sick of talking to you, you might have to just let it go and say, maybe we can chat another time about this. But I find that's why it's helpful to just ask, instead of making an uncomfortable declaration that puts someone on their toes, you can ask them an uncomfortable question. You say, you know, just to say, well, what does it mean to be pregnant? They have a life in you. Well, what kind of life? A human life. Well, what kind of human life? Is it a young life, an old life? It's a young human life. What do we call young human lives? Like, do we call them babies? Is that okay? What does abortion do to these babies? Like, well, what happens to them? And so instead of just, so notice there, I'm taking a circuitous scenic route to the conclusion abortion kills babies. And I could just say that, but it's also when you slowly get there, it's more impactful for the person to realize, oh, wow, that really does stick with me when they have to go through the questions. Mm-hmm. It's sort of like how Alfred Hitchcock, the famous horror movie director, he once talked about how there's two ways you could shock an audience. Like in a scene, let's say there's a bomb hidden under the table. You can have people at the dinner table eating and then the bomb goes off and it's like, oh, wow, and this is really shocking and it hits you. But the way the scene really sticks with people is if you keep cutting to the bomb under the table and they're eating and the bomb and the table and the bomb in it, that builds suspense when you cut back and forth. So it's like when you ask questions that lead people to that very uncomfortable conclusion, it's almost like you're building that sort of suspense that sticks with them.
Mm.
It sticks with them more. And if you think about it, like, I think about like the scariest scenes in horror films, it's usually not like a jump scare, though sometimes those can be, you know, very famous. A lot of times it's the scenes that specifically build suspense with people, that it's like, oh, here it comes. Oh man, that's more long lasting. And so I think there's something similar when we use a question-based approach to put people towards those uncomfortable conclusions instead of just declaring them.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that completely makes sense. And I think a lot of people need to more or less take the approach, not just with the pro-life movement, but also Catholicism and apologetics, because too many people are just quick to just, you know, be like, we don't worship Mary and you're dumb and blah, blah, blah. Instead of being like, well, where did you hear that? Why do you believe we worship Mary? You know?
Yeah. And what do you think worship is?
Right. And I think that also creates a connection, because then you're asking them so they know you care about what they're thinking or what they believe. Now, sometimes that can obviously go over the line and they kind of, you give them an inch, they run with a mile, but that's very few people.
And you have to redirect with questions and get focused back on the main issue for sure.
Yeah. Little ADHD over there.
True. It happens.
I think, you know, kind of just wrapping up, and I guess this is going to be the last big hitting one that kind of ruffles a couple feathers though, because this is one that I constantly have to face online and explain to people. And that is the death penalty. And how being pro-life does not always mean being anti-death penalty. And I guess just trying to make that, make a broader audience understand that an innocent life is different from like a convicted killer or a murderer or something like that.
Well, what's interesting with the death penalty is you can flip it on its head. So you can, for someone who is a pro-choice advocate, you can say, you know, why are you against abortion before the death penalty? You know, the church teaches the death penalty is inadmissible, but there are many pro-lifers who are against abortion but see nothing wrong with the death penalty. But I like, when in these cases, I like to flip it on its head and say, because most of those pro-abortion advocates, I would say, are you for the death penalty? And most of them would say, no, I'm against the death penalty. And I'd say, okay, why are you against the death penalty? Well, because the state shouldn't be, you know, shouldn't be killing people, and some of these people are innocent. But even for the guilty people, it's, yeah, even there, you know, they're still a human being. Okay, so you're in favor for the death penalty for a convicted murderer, but not, but, you're against the death penalty for a convicted murderer. You want to spare the life of a convicted murderer, but you're not willing to spare the life of a child who is innocent of any wrongdoing. That, to me, seems much more inconsistent. Why is a murderer's life valuable enough to spare from death, but not an unborn child? So I think when this comes up, what's helpful is just to flip it around on the other person. I mean, you can make the distinction between executing the guilty to protect the common good of society and a child who's done nothing. But I think when you flip it around, they're in the much more uncomfortable position.
Yeah, no, you're totally right. Because I think it kind of puts them, it makes them think. And I think that's the real thing that we lack in today's society is just thinking for yourself.
True.
And that's something that I've noticed is if you do ask the questions, if you are more likely to kind of flip it on them, like you're saying, and do those things, well, first of all, either you're going to get blocked or they're actually going to start, the wheels will actually start turning in their head, and they're actually going to start realizing that, like, oh, maybe that's interesting. And it's just really interesting to kind of see how the culture has changed, and how even after Roe v. Wade, we're still obviously facing these issues because we knew we would face it on the state level. True. But even then, the language changing and making things more vague so that they pass things that, you know, seem okay, but aren't, like, you know, like you said, Florida's Amendment 4, they used such vague language in that amendment that people were like, oh yeah, that seems fine.
Right.
But in reality, it was like abortion up until birth. And then also parents wouldn't know if their underage minor child was getting an abortion. It was just insane to me how they could pass this and people just not even look at. But then again, miscarriage is also defined as a spontaneous abortion now. So,
So I think that's why we should use terms. We might even have to use terms like elective abortion or banning abortion for birth, you know, abortion for birth control as the primary reason abortion is used, to help people see this is not just about a bunch of rare cases. But I mean, that's strategy. I'm not an expert in that. What I just try to do is get people to defend the pro-life argument and show how the pro-life position, you know, it should make sense.
Yeah. Do you have any tips, tricks, or resources that you could give the listeners to help them better be pro-life advocates?
Yeah, always get the conversation back to the question, what are the unborn? Always go back there and get people to answer that question. If you like help in your conversations, I would recommend my book, Persuasive Pro-Life. There's a new edition out. I think it's the only edition you'll find now. I think we sold out of the first edition finally on Amazon. It has a white cover, but it's Persuasive Pro-Life. It's the post Roe v. Wade edition, the second edition of my book, revamped, reworked. It's basically a brand new book. And I'm really excited for a lot of good that it's doing. So if you want to grow deeper, even if you have the first edition, I'd recommend getting the second edition online. There's a lot more content in it. And I think it's going to be really beneficial to people. They can go and check out. The book is Persuasive Pro-Life, second edition.
That's perfect. Yeah, I think that'll help a lot of people. And I'm going to go buy it now too, because the first book, like I said, that your book, Persuasive Pro-Life, was the first pro-life book I ever read and really helped me understand how to engage the pro-choice side in no matter what the argument was, because you gave examples, you gave specifics, and you know, even like charts and statistics and everything. So that was extremely helpful.
Thank you guys so much for listening. Be sure to check out Amber Rose's podcast, The Religious Hippie, as well. And I hope you all have a blessed weekend.